What's up?
What's going on?
Oh, not much, buddy. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. What's new and exciting?
Got a good tirade lined up, so everything's good there.
That's good. That's good. So I guess we'll just dive right into it and see where it brings us. How's that sound?
Sure. That sounds good.
All right. Hello, everyone. This is show number 2. Call this a bonus episode. I say that because normally you're getting bonus episodes towards the end of a season, but what's different with us, because we always do things a little bit differently, you're getting a bonus beginning episode just because we have some conflict with our first interviewer schedule. So
things are off to a very good start here.
Off to a very great start. We'd like to do things a little bit differently anyway, so we give you a bonus in the beginning.
We do this for you, so you should thank us.
It's been a very interesting week since we last tuned in. The Oscars were over the weekend. Very fun times.
Riveting, riveting ceremony.
I think the last time I watched the Oscars was when Chris Rock hosted in 2016. And I'm pretty sure that was my last because they decided not to bring him back again. He really is one of like the funniest comedians of all time. Like I put him on par with George Carlin. I will say it. Like he's hysterical.
He's one of those guys who I feel like he's unable to do anything but like keep it real. I do have to agree. I think he's one of the better ones out there.
He's coming out with a Saw movie. He wrote it himself. I think he's directing it, and he's also starring in a Saw movie with Samuel Jackson.
Like the actual Saw, like Jigsaw?
He's making a copycat killer called Spiral. It's another Saw movie. It's in the Saw franchise, but it's a copycat killer, and he plays he plays a cop along with Samuel Jackson, who's his dad, who's also a cop. And the killer is going after cops.
No shit.
Yeah. I'm actually pretty excited for it. I mean, a lot of people are just like, what is this? And it's like, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. It's Chris Rock. There'll be like those thriller violent movie, but then there's going to be those comedic tones throughout that you know, you're just going to laugh.
There's one thing Chris Rock is really good at, and it's like dark comedy. Top 10 is a slept on movie of his, but I think kind of showcased him as a director and an actor. And you know, it wasn't all just laughs the whole time. It paced itself and set you up. I thought it was good. I never understood why that movie didn't get a little more traction.
That was a great movie. We saw that in South Carolina, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Yep.
That was a good one. So the Oscars were on, pretty sure it got the worst ratings in history, and they try to blame it on the very last award given. Apparently, Anthony Hopkins won Best Actor. Unfortunately, the Oscar did not go to our late Chadwick Boseman, our Black Panther. So I guess a lot of people are saying is the ratings fall amid Best Actor controversy. But I have to say, if it's the last award given, how are you going to blame your ratings on that? It doesn't make any sense. So the media, like they always do, trying to create something that is just a failing show. Nobody wants to watch a bunch of elite actors blow each other.
Yeah, I think people are getting tired of the idea of the upper class patting themselves on the back. I think personally, you know, the sort of hypocrisy of it all can be summed up by the fact that in LA, they had to clear out a couple encampments of homeless people that were around the theater. And then later on in the night, the movie Nomadland, which is about homeless people, goes on to win this movie, I think.
Oh, Nomadland? Yeah. The one with the woman, picture. The woman from, what's it called? She was in all the Coen Brothers movies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Frances McDormand. Yep. Yeah. That movie ends up winning for its, you know, really intimate depiction of, you know, homeless people. And there you go. They had to clear out all the homeless people in order for all the rich people to get together and pat themselves on the back for how much they understand them. So, you can't write that. That's Coen Brothers couldn't even write that.
No, they couldn't. They couldn't. And I'll tell you, I do get curious with the Oscars, like to see what movies are nominated, even though I don't watch it anymore. Like I still want to know what wins. This was the first year I went through the whole list of movies and all the nominations. And I didn't watch a single movie in any category that was nominated this year. None. Not a single one. I'm like, what did I miss? I mean, 2020 was bad, but there were still movies out. So, you know, interesting fact here. So the Best Actor Award, there was somebody who won it initially, and it was already all planned out. So there's a movie out called Unhinged with Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe won an award for Best Actor in 2000 for Gladiator. And in this movie, Unhinged, he did a phenomenal job, the Academy thought. He played an angry, middle-aged, fat, violent white man. He got road rage, and he started going after this girl. And it was already predetermined he was going to win because he did such a phenomenal job. However, the Academy got word that he wasn't acting. So he had to get disqualified.
Yeah, if he was acting, he was acting normally.
So Unhinged, one of the only movies that I mean, maybe not the only one, but like it was a half decent movie, I guess, for 2020. One of the other surprise movies that I really liked was Palm Springs with Andy Samberg. It was actually really funny. It's like one of the better time movies where was it another Happy Death Day movie where she keeps waking up and she has to start her whole day over kind of thing. Oh, right. I never saw it, but Palm Springs was like that. And it was just it was really good. You got to just keep living the same day over again. But like it was actually a fun day of living over again. So rather than there like being like a problem, I mean, there was a problem because there's no movie without a problem, but it was like waking up to fun and then you get to live your whole day. But I guess like, you eventually get tired of having fun.
Yeah.
I mean, right. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, if I woke up and every day was fun, we could replay March Madness weekend. I would replay March Madness weekend all over again.
I would definitely do that.
But yeah, so that was the Oscars. It's a terrible, you know, it's a terrible show. The ratings are low. I just think people are over it. I don't think it has anything to do with who won what award. It's who really cares who wins
at this point. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like you said, you know, I'm looking at the movies that were nominated for best film and, Nomadland, I at least heard of, but I never watched it, but the rest of them, The Sound of Metal, I never remember seeing anything about that movie, like being promoted or anything. I don't know even where I could have watched that movie.
I think that movie has a half decent premise. I don't even know where to watch it. It's about a guy who, I guess, is a drummer and he loses his hearing. Cause I am assuming when you are in a metal band, you're hurting your eardrums.
Yeah, you gotta, you know, I'm sure wear headphones.
I'm sure
that's what happened to Phil Collins. Phil Collins lost his hearing pretty much because of all the, and he wasn't even playing metal. You know, all that exposure to loud sound over time, it really makes it so you can't hear shit.
I wonder if I should lower the volume in my car.
Yeah, I don't know. I think a couple hours exposure of Ludacris on full blast every day is not really going to do too much damage.
Yeah, you're probably right. Remember back in high school and in college when we used to just have the windows down blasting our rap music all across Kingston?
Yeah, what was that? It was a Jay-Z song, I remember. The Takeover.
The Takeover.
That song had a good Doors sample in it. And the bass was like super boosted. I remember.
Then there was Juvenile Shine with Lil Wayne. And then we had that E-40 song. What was the E-40 song again?
Was it the Snap Your Fingers one?
Snap Your Fingers. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It wasn't fingers. It was fangas.
Fangas. Snap Your Fingers. That was our summer. Just blasting those 4 or 5 songs on repeat, driving to the same spot every single day. So really, we did live like a happy death day, Palm Springs situation. You know, way back, it's just we didn't get to relive it. Time-wise, we just literally did the same thing every weekend.
Yeah.
What else happened this week?
Well, there was that Mayweather fight.
Oh, happened. Yeah, the Floyd Mayweather and that Logan Paul or Paul Logan. What the hell is his name?
Logan Paul? Oh, yeah, it was rescheduled. See, Logan Paul is an interesting character because you want to know something? I really don't think he should be in the ring with Floyd Mayweather. I don't know about that.
I'm sure with Mayweather, this is all just a cash grab. I mean, if there were any way for both of them to lose, I wish that could be an outcome.
It goes like 4 or 5 rounds, and then like they both throw punches at the same time and knock each other out. What do you think the odds would be on that?
Plus a million, probably $1 to win $1 million. You know,
I'm saying. There's like one guy in like, he's like real drunk in a bar in like Tulsa or something. He accidentally threw like $5 on it because he was too drunk to see the screen. And then he finds out he won like $5 million. He's like, what?
Yeah, it's like that one time we were at Brown Bear and there was that match where I'm like, guys, it's going to be a draw. Let's bet on the draw.
Yeah,
and you and Scott are both like, fight. No. No, yeah. That's the dumbest bet. That's the dumbest bet you can obviously make. You know there's not going to be a draw, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
And lo and behold, the first time I didn't even listen to myself. I didn't even bet on the draw because I'm like, let me just bet with you and Scott. And there was a draw. I was so mad.
Yeah, I'd be mad if I were you too. But in my defense, at least, there was no way I saw a draw coming with that. I saw Tyson Fury as a surefire winner. I mean, the guy's just such a bar brawler. I mean, you could see, even when he gets knocked out, like, you could see, like, the cogs turning. It's like, at one point, he was on the ground. He got pretty much knocked out for a second. I mean, he was out cold. And then all of a sudden, his eyes sprung open like he was a Terminator. And he just stood up, and he was like, oh, it's time to fight again. Like the dude can't stop.
Though, at the end of the day, I was still a winner because I got to hang out with my two best friends. Drink, gamble, lose. be annoyed at it for a little bit, get over it, go to sleep, wake up the next day, do it all over again. Except this time, not gamble.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I really want New York to legalize the whole gambling thing. I mean, I think it's about time now. Well, I mean,
I'm sure Cuomo is going to do something to get everyone's mind off all the bullshit he's going through. So
that's true.
Legalize gambling is probably next. He'll legalize gambling. He'll legalize prostitution. And then at some point, I'm sure he'll legalize cocaine use, just so everybody forgets about all the stuff he's done lately.
Yeah. Yeah. We're like two scandals away from him just having an Amsterdam take on drugs. Like anything goes.
Yeah, pretty much.
You want to do your mushrooms or your psychedelics, you know, your acid or your molly, but you go ahead.
But I guess, you know, this whole scandal that he's going through, I didn't follow it too much. I just don't like the guy, and I'm glad I'm kind of leaving New York, so I really don't have to care what's going on. But you're there, my family's there, so I have to care a little bit. But that whole scandal with the, you know, with the Me Too, the, what is it? Do I call it the Me Too piece or the sex scandal? What do you actually call it? Let everyone's mind.
Scandal. Yeah.
The what scandal?
Harassment scandal.
The harassment scandal that got everyone's mind off the whole nursing home cover up, which I also don't really know much about either.
It's getting worse by the day as the details come out. Apparently, his aides were working overtime to make sure that the numbers reported were all just wrong. At the same time, Mr. Cuomo was pitching a book. I think that whole situation was kind of a perfect storm, right? Because you had Donald Trump who was mismanaging the pandemic from the highest levels, and he was doing such a bad job that he made somebody as incompetent as Andrew Cuomo look like he knew exactly what he was doing. So it has to be in that context that you look at it and just see just how bad it was. So you got March 2020, the administration puts in policy the nursing homes can't turn away patients that were discharged from hospitals after treatment for COVID-19. Then you got old people dying because they're exposed to COVID. And the administration says that's around 6,000, right? But then it became clear in like 2 months that not everybody was being tallied. And you want to, of course, approach something like that. Well, the media wants to approach something like that in light of Cuomo being the good guy and Trump being the bad guy as, you know, an honest mistake on Cuomo's part. And then it turned out that they undercounted by as much as 50%. When they started looking into it more, they realized that, you know, Cuomo's administration was deliberately underreporting. And as of this month, they've, you know, retallied and it's up almost 16,000 now.
So 16,000 people died in a nursing home and they said it was another cause, or did they just say that 16,000 less people died?
Yeah. So, well, they had reported 6,000 in the beginning, and then people were skeptical of that number from the beginning. They said that seems really low. So then people started looking into it and they pressured the administration into doing a recount, and now that everybody's counting and got eyes on the data and making sure that, you know, it all lines up correctly, now all of a sudden the numbers are spiking way up and they're realizing it was way underreported. It's starting to come out that it was done deliberately, so you can't say it wasn't done with the intention of trying to sweep it under the rug. And I mean, it's hard. Nobody knows what you're going to do in the event of a pandemic like this. I mean, this is something unprecedented. So a misstep is almost kind of expected, but it's also kind of expected. A little bit of transparency from, you know, your elected officials is supposed to be the norm. So when things are being deliberately underreported, meanwhile, you know, you talk about the elite blowing themselves. Cuomo gets an Emmy for his daytime briefings on the coronavirus. And, you know, he's got a skeleton like this in the closet. Eventually, enough people's families are going to say, hey, wait a minute. I mean, I don't know how you think that you can get away with something like this without reporting the numbers. And I think that's ultimately it. It was a criticized plan from the beginning. And this was what people said was going to happen. And now it did happen. And as much as the administration didn't want it to happen and fudged the numbers to make it seem like that wasn't happening, now it did. You know, it's got people understandably a little upset. So I could see it from both sides, but at the end of the day, you got to be honest. You know, you got to own up.
It seems like all politicians have math or number problems. No, like they just, I don't know if they don't have mathematics in political courses, but you almost like to think with all of the numbers between polling cases, you know, anything with a number, it seems like politicians just can't count. Or they read a zero wrong and they think it's a period or something.
I think it boils down to like the politicians got to be the charismatic one, right? And the numbers guys aren't necessarily the charismatic ones. The bean counters are just kind of the nerd behind the scenes who they aren't the most personable people. And I think politicians need people like that in their corner, obviously. But when it comes to making things sound good for the public, I think the charismatic side sort of wins out as like the devil on the shoulder that makes somebody want to underreport things to look good.
Well, everybody wants to look good. So, yeah. But I guess when you're finagling coronavirus cases, it's going to have a bad aftermath if you're off by that much. I would think, though, that a state would want to have higher numbers so that they get more of a bailout check. So
he didn't want to look like he was responsible for all those people's deaths after being criticized for having this plan and going ahead with it anyway. And, you know, it's a shame to say that something like this can happen, you know, in the office of a politician so esteemed as, you know, the New York governor, you know, where the honorable likes of Elliot Spitzer have then held the position, you know. I mean, like, it's really disgraceful.
Well, now, can he run again or is this it?
Oh, no, he can run again. You can run. I don't think there's any limit on how many times. I don't think there's any limit on how many times somebody can run for governor.
Wow. Well, that sucks because he basically said he'll never step down. So he's just going to keep on going.
The governor is not eligible to serve more than 8 years in any 12-year period.
He can run again.
Yeah.
And then technically he could take a year or two off.
Yeah.
And then run another 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, man. I foresee some big demographic shifts going on in New York. And I mean, I don't think it's going to ultimately mean much, but I think with a lot of people leaving the city and kind of dispersing throughout the East Coast, it's going to change some voting district in the state, at least. I think New York's going to be one of those vote blue no matter who kind of states anyway, but it'll be interesting to see just how it changes.
I mean, I think it'd be pretty cool if there's another Democrat that runs against him and gets the actual party primary win.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Because if he runs for re-election, right, and he gets backed by the Democratic caucus, do you realize that then they didn't care about his harassment case? They're kind of brushing the coronavirus thing under the rug. Like, he should not be backed by anyone. Whether he's popular or not, anybody that decides to back him is then supporting his claim of innocence on the harassment piece. And also, this 16,000 coronavirus mistake is truly a mistake. But common sense here. Is it a mistake? I mean, are there really people going to be like, you know, it was a mistake? And like, you're not going to look at them like they have five heads.
Like, I mean,
it's obviously not a mistake, but are we going to brush it under the rug and be like, you know, tomato, tomato, 16,000, 1600, you know?
Yeah. Hey, Fredo, can you count? I can't. I mean, I'm okay with a character arc for Andrew Cuomo that involves him just getting bullied by just bringing up bad things that he's done, and you just bully him in making all kinds of concessions that he wouldn't normally make. You know, I'm all right. New York getting a little more liberal when it comes to actual policies instead of being an establishment Democrat hub. Like I said, I think we're only a couple scandals away from getting some real, real good drug policies and gambling policies in New York State. I think it's going to become a real fun place. We just got to dig up a little more dirt on Cuomo before 2022.
I'll tell you, I think the gambling thing is just right around the corner. It's interesting living in Pennsylvania, going to Jersey with FanDuel, because that's my app of choice for gambling. And I have to say, like, there's different weird rules, right? So in Pennsylvania, I can use my face to log in with FanDuel when I'm in Pennsylvania. But once I cross the border to New Jersey, I can't use face recognition to log in. I have to type in my password. And the other interesting thing is you can't see your bets from different states when you're in a different state, right?
That's weird. That's really strange. Why would that matter?
But they still cash. you can still cash it and get your money if you win in another, like if the ticket, let's just say I put the bet in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. right? And I go to New Jersey. When I go to New Jersey and I look at my bets pending, I don't see my active bets. Like I need to log in through like a whole different system to see my bets in Pennsylvania. However, if it wins, it still cashes and it goes into my account, even though I'm in a different state.
Well, that's bizarre, Gus.
I'm sure New York, what's going to happen is, you know, if Cuomo's in charge of it, probably for every dollar won, he gets a penny.
Yeah.
Ooh, I got a new pair of Crocs today in the mail.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I didn't know you were a Croc-wearing man.
Listen, around the house, Tommy's dog walking slippers are now Crocs. You know, I had like a camo pair of them at one point. They were awesome. And then I don't know what happened to them. But the ones I got now have a design on them like a 90s math textbook, and it's badass.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with them.
I bought two loafers from Aldo's, and I love them. But every year I complain about Aldo because they only last for the summer normally. They're an expensive shoe that really doesn't have quality anymore. It's just they pay us and they go away.
Yeah. I mean, they're super nice to look at, but they're kind of like the Maserati of shoes. Like they, you know, they're nice for like the first year, but once you start putting mileage on them, it's like, oh boy.
Yeah. It's just like, you never went down in price and they just disintegrate. Like it's literal disintegration with these shoes.
Yeah.
And the dress shoes hurt after some time. Like you only can wear their shoes for like 4 hours to 5 hours. And then it's like, all right, my foot hurts.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a pair of Aldos that were sick and they had this was back in like shit, like 2009. And they had like a buckle on them. They had like three buckles on them and they were like, they were like canvas shoes. They had the rubber sole and everything and they were sick. And then I want to say it was like 2 weeks. The buckle broke off and I was like, God damn it. And then I glued it on, but it was just never the same.
Yeah.
At that point, you just have to like walk softly and hope it like doesn't fly off your foot.
Even Nikes. I'm still riding my Nikes that I bought 3 years ago because they're just perfect. And I can't seem to find those exact pair again. I don't understand why sneakers can't be like t-shirts where like you always have the same kind available so you can just buy. It's kind of like the dad New Balance. They always have those loser shoes, but then they don't have like the cool Nike shoes that you bought one summer and then they're just gone. They just stop making them.
Yeah, it's true. You got to look real hard to find any kind of shoes that were cool like 10 years ago. And yeah, I feel like maybe I'm just getting old. It's like the old man yells at cloud meme. Old Tom yells at new shoes. But shoes now are stupid. Like they got those shoes that are like socks with the rubber sole on them. And I mean, I get that I sound like a super old dick just yelling about it. But I mean, like what the hell? It doesn't make any sense to me. It's like how could a shoe like that possibly last? Like, I get it, it's probably comfortable as all shit, but
maybe you're not meant to wear them outside and you're only supposed to wear them in the house like your Crocs.
Well, then that's a slipper. I mean, that really impedes the functionality of a shoe, I would think.
I would say I bought them once. I treated myself once to a pair of Prada shoes. And like, it took a lot for me to pay that kind of money for a pair of shoes. Like, I won't do it again. I'm better off now than I was the time that I bought those Prada shoes. But I'm like, I shouldn't be buying another pair of these. But I will tell you, you could wear those shoes all day and they were comfortable. So you're paying for it's like a mattress, right? So like you might as well buy a good mattress because you're going to be sleeping in it for quite a bit of time. So the same thing with shoes. I mean, I guess I'd rather have a really good pair of comfortable shoes than expensive jeans, because to me, all jeans kind of feel the same. Whether you're paying $150 for a pair of jeans or $40 for a pair of jeans, they kind of feel the same. Maybe the $40 ones don't last as long as the $150 jeans, but with shoes, it's your feet. You're walking on them, right? So it's like a mattress. Shoes are like a mattress. So I guess maybe you should spoil yourself with shoes a little bit more.
That's one of the main arguments for what people call the poverty tax, which is when they say that, like, you know, people who are poor remain poor because they have to spend more money on things that rich people are able to buy, like one of, that's really good, that lasts for a while. And like shoes are an example they use, like, or boots or anything like that. Like, you know, the poor guy can only pay $25 for a pair of boots, let's say, and the rich guy can spend $100. And then every year, the poor guy's got to buy a new pair of boots at $25 a piece. And meanwhile, the rich guy's boots last him 10 years. So over 10 years, he spent $100. And over 10 years, the poor guy spent $250 on boots.
Well, yeah, you know, you get what you pay for at the end of the day. It's quality of work. Tell you one thing though, it's like appliances. They don't make appliances like they used to anymore. And I feel like whether you're rich or poor and you have to buy a dishwasher, that dishwasher is going to last you the same amount of time, because they don't make them like they used
to. Time out here for a second. Okay. So today, when I was headed home from work, I was stuck behind a Cavalier station wagon. Now, if you're old enough to remember the Chevy Cavalier of the early 90s, it was a piece of shit. It was not the type of car that one would intentionally keep around. It was fairly ugly. It had no notable characteristics at all. It had an anemic engine in it. It was a little four-cylinder. It sucked. The car itself sucked. It was one of the cheapest cars that GM ever produced, and there was no reason to have one. My parents had one. It sucked. It was constantly breaking down, and it was not a good car. But nevertheless, here in 2021, I found myself stuck behind one. I'm going to guess it was probably a first gen. So what's that? 92, I think. And it was terrible. All kinds of things wrong with it. It got me thinking, you don't really see too many of those kind of cars around anymore. The adage on the internet is that, you know, everything is a product of planned obsolescence now. And depending on how much of a connoisseur of internet conspiracy theories you are, maybe you're familiar with this idea already, but the popular sentiment on the internet is that every company is involved in some form of planned obsolescence, where they build products that are intentionally shitty so that they'll break and then they get you to buy a new one, right? Oxford Dictionary defines it as a policy of producing consumer goods that rapidly become obsolete and so require replacing, achieved by frequent changes in design, termination of the supply of spare parts, and the use of non-durable materials. Or as your grandfather would probably say, they don't make them like they used to, right? And he's not totally wrong. Now, the idea of planned obsolescence is not a new one. It goes all the way back to the 20s with Alfred P. Sloan, who was the chairman of GM at the time. He wanted to compete with Ford making the Model T by enticing consumers to buy new GMs. And the way he did that was he marketed the new ones as better. He made the consumer feel inferior for having one that was a couple years old but still ran just fine, right? Even he didn't come up with that idea alone, because in 1924, the biggest light bulb manufacturers all met in Geneva and established what was called the Phoebus Cartel, who determined that the standard operating hours of a light bulb at the time needed to be reduced from the industry standard of 2,000 hours or 1,500 hours down to 1,000 hours. So this is the part where all the internet sleuths go insane and they say, look, see, it's a conspiracy right from the top. All the way back in the 20s, it was determined, and it's all gone crazy by now. You got to look at it with a little bit more perspective than that. I mean, it's all well and good when you're talking about tungsten coils and old light bulbs, because they're easy to manufacture, right? When you're talking about silicon wafers made into the microchips that go into all the consumer electronics today, it's not as easy to produce those. And only a few big companies like Broadcom do. You've got a boom in consumer electronics, right? Where a lot of people want more of these things. And COVID was a large influence in that. You've got things like a 14, 15 week wait time for silicon chips produced today, right? The wait is getting longer and longer for these companies to get these chips. This inability to keep up with demand leads to a shortage, and that impacts everybody, not even just, you know, Sony with PlayStations and Apple iPhones. It all impacts cars like Ford and BMW, right? And I mean, at this point in time, around 40% of a car's cost is from the electronics that are in it. This comes from the IHS. Right? That was a survey they did. Now, compare that to 2000, all the automotive electronics in a car cost about 18% of it. So obviously, the smarter cars get, the quicker the electronics become obsolete. And if you don't believe me, get in a car that was made before 2006 and tell me you don't feel like you're in the vehicular equivalent of a dollar store desk calculator. Now, Demand for these newer models creates a vacuum that can't be satisfied, which drives prices up. And meanwhile, newish cars become rapidly obsolete and the electronic components become more and more expensive to fix. So planned obsolescence only works as long as the supply chain allows it. You can't keep producing newer and newer vehicles if all of a sudden you can't get the parts to make them anymore. And meanwhile, the ones that you've recently produced, new-ish, they're getting too expensive to fix because the electronic parts that were producing them were never designed to be fixed. They were designed to be replaced by the newer models, right? The worst part of this whole thing is the blame doesn't even really rest on the auto manufacturers. I know you'd like it to. I would like it to. But the fact is, it really rests on us, the consumer. And I'm not one to usually blame the consumer over a big corporation if I ever can. But in this case, it really is our fault. We stand for it. We're the ones who want the newer and better products. And the compromise with these companies churning out newer and better products is they don't care about the longevity of them because they're only concerned with selling new ones. They don't care about the longevity of those products because their balance sheets are based on how many they can sell. Ultimately, the takeaway here is that we as a society really need to think about possibly not always getting the newest shit, right? We need a little bit of a paradigm shift here. And the focus needs to be not always getting the newest shit, but instead getting good, reliable shit. And as for companies, profits shouldn't always come first. It's unrealistic to think that year-over-year growth is sustainable. I mean, it's not. You can't have unlimited growth. You got to look back at Alfred P. Sloan in the 20s. This was hardly a concern of his, but nobody in the 20s could have predicted the rise in consumer electronics like it is nowadays. I mean, he wouldn't even have predicted the likes of Elvis Presley, and he probably would have had a heart attack on the spot if you showed him Cardi B's WAP. The point is, the idea of newer and better shit isn't only not even new, it's already showing its age. And that's the tirade today.
I got to tell you, I mean, I personally do think that they're constantly competing to be better and better. You launch something yesterday and you got to have something better today. And it sucks that that's the society that we've in. Technology has moved so fast that we replaced ourselves with what we're building. Like the social media age, it took about 17 years or so to get to where it did today. But then the being able to control your life on your smartphone, it went from landline telephone to flip phone. And then when Apple came out with their first iPhone or whatever, like it started the war of who can do more now. Every day, there's just constantly something, you know, a better phone. They just constantly want to, get better and better.
The next product. Yeah. The next thing coming out. I mean, for Christ's sake, everybody's been there where you buy the newest model of phone and within a couple months, there's some sub model of that phone that's coming out that's even better. And it's like, it's got a two millimeter thinner screen, or it's got, you know, a half inch bigger display. Like, for Christ's sake, like the downsides of capitalism, I think it's that, you know, it really needs to be looked at how much we really do need new things.
That's what the media sold us on. You got to have the new best thing. I mean, do you ever think Apple is going to come up with the indestructible waterproof iPhone? Absolutely not.
No. And I mean, you saw it happen with, phones where suddenly you couldn't replace a battery anymore. And, you know, the studies I was reading, they had an engineer talking about it. But basically, what he was saying was, in terms of designing phones, the main thing that they saw when they were designing them was that once the battery died, the whatever the electronic device was to them didn't seem like it was good anymore. Like once the battery died, in their mind, they kind of fell out of love with the electronic device they had. They wanted a new one now. And batteries are supposed to die. Like they're supposed to get to a point where you can't use them anymore. I mean, a lead acid battery can only be recharged, or a lithium battery can only be recharged so many times. And the acid inside it can only go back and forth so many times before eventually it stops working. And the internal components of it become so corroded that it can't be used anymore. And at that point, it's just, you got to get a new battery. Once batteries stop becoming replaceable in phones, I think that was the beginning of the end.
Man, if I were born right now and I had another 30 years on top of my 30 years already, I would be a little upset because it's just,
oh my God,
it's all going to go downhill from here.
Dude, I would be a little worried if I were young and watching the state of the world right now.
How is real estate going?
Yeah, you know, I'm surprisingly busy still. You know, it's a shame that not a lot of my FHA clients are getting the opportunity to put in offers. It's basically everyone has to be conventional, no seller's concession, and
Right now,
leave your fucking appraisal, like pretty much like it's you put in an offer, and if it's not high enough, hopefully you have the money to cover the difference. It's sad how quick everything is going, but if people are happy, then and they don't have buyer's remorse, that's all that matters. That's
yeah, you know, as long as they're getting decent houses. And now, I mean, with as much rehabbing as is going into a lot of houses right now, I think ultimately, you know, that's probably a pretty good thing for the American housing market.
Yeah, I still have a lot of renovation loans that are coming in, which is great. Those are pretty fantastic.
That makes sense. That's a lot of that is happening around me right now. You know, people are buying houses that maybe have been slept on the last few rounds of, you know, things getting bought up around here. And people aren't afraid to buy, you know, the shittier house and put a little bit of elbow grease into it to make it something better. And that's good. I think that's a good thing on a lot of levels. You know, it's good to have a portion of society that's, you know, involved in like the idea of like, you know, getting their hands dirty and making something good out of something that maybe is a little bit in need of repair. And yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, I know personally for me, the idea of doing manual work like that is good. I enjoy it, even though sometimes it sucks. It's still ultimately like something I could be proud of myself when I'm finished. And yeah, who knows? Maybe if more people start doing that and more people start seeing the value of like, you know, working with their hands and stuff like that, yeah, maybe it makes for a little bit happier of people in our generation.
Yeah, maybe. I think the one benefit about it is that when people do the 203K loans, they're able to cosmetically do what they want, because it always seems that when people rush into the things, they don't love the kitchen, and then they're going to be out the money as soon as they move in. We'll handle it when we get the place. At least with these renovation loans, you can do your cosmetic upgrades within the loan. So you're not taking out a Home Depot or a Lowe's credit card or even shorter term loan with them on the housing adjustment. Because I think those rates are probably in the sevens if you do the loan, like the second mortgage loan.
Yeah.
Or yeah. You know, but that's with Home Depot directly. I know there's better like actual second mortgages, but even with the credit card, putting stuff on the credit card, maybe you get a 5% discount when you do the purchase, and then maybe you get interest free for a few months. But
yeah,
being able to do it in the first loan is, you know, it's a pretty big deal that you're able to do that.
Now, you just mentioned something that I didn't even know was a thing. Home Depot offers an actual loan you can take out against your house.
See, I don't know how they do it exactly, but they are now in the home improvement business. Like you can do your roof, your deck, your siding projects through Home Depot. Now, I think what happens,
I've seen signs for that they offer financing on things like that.
And I never assume it's like, what do they call it? I think they call it a mechanics lien. So it's a higher interest loan that you do, but they do put it on the property.
Mm-hmm.
So those end up being a little bit more expensive, but I also don't think they're doing an appraisal. I don't think they're a 30-year fixed loan. I think they're only like, I think they're like 10 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're in the business now of making money on those projects, which I'm sure what's happening is you can be like a preferred Home Depot or Lowe's contractor. Home Depot puts on a VIG, or you know, they get, you know, they send out the contractor, and whatever the quote ends up being, they get like, I'm sure 20 or 30% of the fee from the contractor.
Yeah.
What would actually be really smart is for Home Depot and Lowe's to get on the 203K train, and basically they be the GC for, like, they hire, you know, your local, go to your local Home Depot or Lowe's for your 203K loan, and they get a GC, and then they back it. So it actually would be a pretty smart idea, because
that is a smart idea. Yeah. And they could, like, get all the local contractors in the area, and then they could be like the approved contractors for different things that Home Depot sublets them to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, it guarantees the products be, you know, all the materials be purchased at Home Depot rather than scattered throughout. But the biggest problem I see with the renovation loans at 203K is, I'm just gonna talk about the full 203K. Let's just say you're doing a $100,000 renovation, so that's considered a full 203K loan, where you gotta get a HUD consultant. And the way the draws work, it's typically you get 20% at the start, and you get periodic 20% draws from the budget that you're doing. So the problem that I've seen is some contractors don't have a budget and they rely on that draw, which at that point, they don't want to do the project because they're laying out more than they can actually handle. Because I'll tell you what, you're never just getting that 20% and you're putting only 20% into it. The contractor's always coming out of pocket a little bit more. So with Home Depot backing it, perhaps they're able to make sure that the contractor is able to fund the project in case they need to dig into their pocket a little bit.
Right.
It's actually not a bad idea because it guarantees them the materials.
Right. And ultimately, they do make money on it. And it's not like a company like them doesn't have the money to throw into division like that.
But, you know, sometimes contractors want to throw percentage on top of the material cost. So I don't know how they would do that if Home Depot were.
How's that any different than a regular 203K loan, though?
What do you mean?
Like,
no, well, that's what I'm saying. If Home Depot was backing the project and giving their cost of materials, that wouldn't give the contractor the opportunity to throw a little bit of VIG on top of the materials. Like
they could offer them to the contractor at a discount, and then the contract gets the difference between what they're getting the materials at versus what their regular retail price of the materials is.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. There's got to be a way, though, to make that work.
We need to approach Home Depot with this. Who's the CEO of Home Depot?
Doesn't he own the Atlanta Falcons?
Does he?
Yeah, I think the CEO owns the Atlanta Falcons.
Craig Menear. He's the chairman and chief executive of Home Depot.
Arthur Blank is he owns 9 enterprises. Also owns the
Atlanta. Lowe's?
Oh, is he Lowe's?
You're looking at the guy from Lowe's? Craig Menear is the CEO of Home Depot.
No. Oh, all right. Arthur Blank is the co-founder of Home Depot. And he's also the owner of the Atlanta Falcons. He may have won the battle of construction department stores, but he has not won a Super Bowl.
Craig Menear apparently made $11.5 million in 2016, which I don't know if that's an obscene amount of money regardless. But in terms of CEO pay, I don't know just how ridiculous that is. Is that a lot? Is that not? I mean, Home Depot had to have made hundreds of millions of dollars in 2016, right? What was Home Depot's gross in 2016?
A lot.
Oh, I'm looking right now. Holy shit. It's in the billions. In fiscal 2016, our sales grew $6.1 billion to a record. They grew $6.1 billion to a record $94.6 billion, an increase of 6.9% from fiscal 2015. Comparable store sales up 5.6% for the company and 6.2% for the U.S. Jesus. They made $6.1 billion more dollars. That's wild. I mean,
that's pretty crazy. Would you say he was worth getting all of that CEO pay, or do you think there were other people beneath him that helped make Home Depot all of that extra money?
Oh, sure. I think probably everybody deserved a piece of that bone. I mean, that's a lot of money. Yes. And sure. maybe the, you know, maybe give the guy a nice bonus. But Jesus Christ, $11.5 million is an obscene amount of money. That's absurd.
No, you see, I had an argument with someone today because I was basically saying, my cousin sent me a WhatsApp message over the weekend, and I, you know, WhatsApp is weird when you get pictures. Sometimes when you see it in the message, you don't see the full picture. So when I saw the picture, I just saw a bunch of CEOs who were making anywhere between $30 million to $250 million for the year of 2020. And it stood out to me that that's a lot of fucking money. And I finally clicked the picture because I wanted to see all 20 of those CEOs. And it was a female congresswoman who basically said, where are all the females? What annoyed me about that was I personally don't care who was on the list, whether it be a man, a woman. What annoyed me was she's now normalizing the amount of money they were made. So let's just forget about how much, let's not forget that one man made $250 million in 1 year. I'm sure that that $250 million comes from bonuses, stock options, all this stuff. But still, at the end of the day, it equated to about $250 million. I don't care if that person's a man or a woman, but the fact that that person is normalizing all of this CEO pay, that's what bothers me. It, you know, 10 years ago, if that were the case, everyone would be talking about, that's a lot of money. That's too much money. Why are they making that kind of money? Now it's, I can't believe there's no females on this list. It's almost like they're normalizing the pay of these people by making it a sex thing.
Well, I mean, if they can distract you by making it an issue based on disparity in gender, then yeah, then you're not as focused on the money itself, the you know, the preposterous amounts of money that these guys make. Instead, yeah, now you're like, hey, why isn't there any women on there? And then when there's a woman who's making, you know, $200 million in a year, then will the world be right.
And so what basically the person I was talking to about this, they were trying to say, well, you shouldn't be upset that somebody's making $250 million a year. They may have turned that company around. They may have made them, you know, they could have had income for the year at X and they grew 300% that year and they deserve all that money. And I'm like, well, that person single-handedly did not come up with a way to quadruple business. You have to look at all the people below them that helped him or her get there. So why not give a bonus to even the guy who cleans the bathroom, a bonus right that year? Even if they had 10,000 employees, right? If you cut that person $100 million, you take that package, that $250 million package, and you cut $100 million off of it, I think $150 million package is still pretty awesome package, don't you think?
Yeah, I still think that's too much money. But yeah, imagine cutting that in half and dispersing the other half among the employees. I mean, it's kind of dystopian in itself that we talk about that as like the better alternative to what happened. But that would be better than what happened.
I mean, $100 million divided by 10,000 people, that's potentially a $10,000 bonus for – that's for 10,000 people, $10,000 bonus. Now, yeah, maybe,
I mean, that's life-changing money to a lot of people.
And maybe the thing is you don't give 10,000 to everyone. I mean, maybe there are of those 10,000 employees, maybe people have only been there for 6 months and maybe you don't give bonuses. So maybe you just give them $1,000. Like, you've been here 6 months, we've grown astronomically. And, you know, this is just a token of our appreciation. And then you divvy up that 9,000 to people who've been there for 15 years. So maybe they're getting a $15,000. You know, you can adjust the money a little bit to seniority, to people who are in sales, people, you know. And then, of course, I get called communist. I'm like, I'm not trying to be a communist. Like, listen, for people who work harder than me, they most absolutely deserve to sit in first class. I'm not somebody who deserves to sit in first class. That's not me. I work hard, but I don't work first class hard. That's my cousin Mario. My cousin Mario works his ass off. He deserves first class seating. I deserve coach with a little bit of extra leg room. Okay. That's all. Like that's.
So you want to know, do you want to know something though? And this is the idea that everybody who sits in first class is there because they work hard is largely bullshit. It's not. A lot of people are in first class simply because they were born in first class and they're just grandfathered into first class forever. They know people who are always going to keep them in first class, and there's no way that they're not going to be in first class. And so they could just putz through life and not do a damn thing right. And they're always going to be in first class because they were just born into generational wealth. I mean, I'm no scholar on Marx or anything, but the idea of, you know, redistributing wealth in this country is not even really a communist one. I mean, it's sort of communal in the idea that, you know, everybody's getting a share of the profits. But, you know, you could have that idea and still be a capitalist at the end of the day. You know, you could have that idea and then still think that, you know, the people who, you know, the working class shouldn't own the means of production. And, you know, you could be for, you know, the idea of wealth distribution in this country without being a communist. So, no, I don't think your idea is communist, Chris. I think whoever said that was just didn't have a rebuttal.
Maybe. I mean, my whole thing was trying to say $250 million package is just a lot, especially with what's going on right now where people are actually making more money collecting unemployment than getting that job at any retail store because retail stores are only paying minimum wage. I mean, the other point that I brought up was, and I'll use Netflix as an example. I think Reed Hastings was on that list. I'm assuming if he founded Netflix, it was basically his idea, right? So he created the whole idea of Netflix. So that's great. I think somebody who came up with that idea deserves to get their payday. It's like coming up with a brand new product. You deserve your payday. You deserve to be a millionaire, blah, blah, blah. Reed Hastings made, I think, 34, I'm going to just call it 34 million. I may be off. I know he was in the 30s, but I have to assume he's been making 30 million consistently over the past decade. So here I am in my head. Okay, he's making $30 million consistently. Anybody that has Netflix is getting an increase in, you know, subscription fees, right? So the whole point is to make more money the following year. So is it the whole point to make more money the following year so Reed Hastings can get an extra $5 million the following year where he's now making $40 million next year? And again, you're going to have people say, well, he's not really getting $40 million. It's his
right. Package. Well,
it's he's getting a liquid. $40 million package. Maybe $30 million of that is in stock. So he can pull mm-hmm. Jeff Bezos in 5 years and just pull all of his fucking money out. It's money at mm-hmm. the end of the day. So how about you lower the subscription fee or honestly put better content on, make a little bit less money and put on more stuff or, you know, give bonuses to some of the other people who are maybe only making $50,000, $60,000 a year. I can't speak bad on Netflix because it is a product I use. It's a product I pay for. But I will say, you know, $35 million, it's a lot of money to be making it consistently every year. But he's taxed a lot. Yes, I get it. He's in the upper tax bracket. But we all know he probably has subsidiary companies that he has where he writes a bunch of stuff off. And I'm sure he's not paying as much in taxes as we are all led to believe that he is, but we're not privy sure. to that because what, you know, what do we know? We don't, why would I look at tax brackets in the millions like that? But where is the distribution of that to the people on the bottom of Netflix's payroll?
Yeah.
And I think
well reported at the top
because everything is going up, you know, like again, deck, it's probably $5,000 more this year to get a deck than it was last year. But if you look at the dip, you know, the pay scale, that's, so what is that? $5,000 difference. Hold on. Let me just do the quick math here. Basically a 30% difference. My pay didn't go up 30%. No. And I doubt a lot, you know, people who were in the same job got a promotion or a pay increase of 30%. Most of these people are getting maybe a $5,000 raise for the whole year. And that's just one project. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just don't like that it turned into a gender argument and not look at what these people are making.
Well, right.
And
right.
Same thing goes for athletes.
Larger argument has a lot less to do with gender and more to do with the idea that there's a very large disparity between two different classes of people, the rich people at the top and the regular people like us. To think that one guy made $200 million in a year, just one year.
Like, and he didn't put $200 million in his pocket. You know, he probably, you know, maybe only put an eighth of that in his pocket. And the rest are bonuses and stock options and, you know.
Even still, to say it's not liquid, right? Because I used to be that person. I used to be the libertarian who was all for the idea of like make as much money as you can. And, you know, that taxation step. I used to be that person. And I used to be the type of schmuck who was online going, oh, well, it's not liquid. Ooh, I wish I could educate you on the difference between liquid assets and, you know, assets from a company, stock options, and blah, blah, blah. And the ultimate answer is like the things he has, even if they're not, especially if they're not liquid, they're generating more wealth. It is ultimately all keeping him much wealthier, you know, than he was previously. And it's making sure that he never, ever is going to leave that tax bracket. And it's also making sure the more he holds onto it and the more wealth it generates for him, that's more wealth that he's holding onto. And it's being sucked away from all the rest of us.
I hate that somebody told me I was kind of a communist. My whole thing is let's stop normalizing $200 million salaries with making it seem like it's a gender problem. It's not a gender problem. It's there are people making too much. They make too much money and we have to stop normalizing that. That's all. That's all I'm trying to get at. Like $200 million is a lot of money. Consistently making $30 million a year. It's a lot of money. I don't think there's a part of me that's, I used to think that way. When I was in college, when I was trying to be a entrepreneur myself, I'm like, I'd love to make $30 million a year. But then seeing the world that we're in, the country keeps growing and people are just not in good shape. I mean, yeah. You gotta give a little bit now. It is what it is. I mean, if the whole country was booming and all people were able to get work and good jobs, I mean, then sure, fine, make your $30 million. But I don't know, making $30 million a year consistently, I just don't think there's enough opportunity out there for the world for someone to make that kind of money consistently. Sure. Again, the Netflix idea was a great idea. So coming up with that original idea, you deserve a major payout. You deserve to be on a level above all of us. Like, I didn't come up with Netflix. You didn't come up with Netflix. Our 4 or 5 degrees of separation, no one came up with Netflix. So yes, you deserve a payout. But now that you got that payout, if you can't live on it and invest or put it elsewhere where you're making money off other investments, $35 million consistently paid from Netflix is too much. I think that money can be dispersed elsewhere and used for other people to make a little bit more.
You know, one CEO who I thought was they kind of paraded him around a little bit in the news circuit, which I didn't really enjoy too much, but I liked at least his idea behind it, was the CEO of Costco. And I don't remember the guy's name, but I remember at the time, this was a couple of years ago, he had capped himself at a $500,000 a year salary. And his logic for that was that, like, yeah, you know, I don't need to make much more than that. And same as any other CEO, a lot of things, he just used company assets, you know. I mean, he didn't do anything differently than other CEOs did, except at the end of it all, he took home $500,000 a year. Don't get me wrong, that's still a lot of money. But, I mean, that's not an egregious amount of money. That's not $200 million in a year money, you know.
Well, you have to realize, though, that on top of that, I mean, these people are making $35 million a year. and they're, I'm sure they have a company cars. They get use of the company jet. So they're making all of this money, and yet they have all of the company perks. So it's not even like,
they're not even spending it most of the day. Like you and I would spend our money to drive to and from work. They don't even have to worry about that.
Yeah, it's all a company expense. Ah, well, this is a business meeting, so I'm going to take the private jet. Let's just say Reed Hastings did make $34 million. Let's say there were no stock options in that. He just has a straight up, I make $34 million a year. It is what it is. With that $34 million, he's not paying for his own jet. It's the company jet. So Netflix is paying for that jet. Netflix is paying for his car. Netflix is paying for his gas. I mean, he's not doing it himself.
He eats dinner that night. He could say it was a meeting with somebody. It's a company expense.
Yeah, it's just money sitting.
That $35 million, he doesn't even have to spend it on most of the necessities that people like you and I have to spend it on, which really drive home just how egregious it is that he would be able to make that amount of money in such a short amount of time, because he's not even beholden to life expenses like the rest of us.
Now, I think a lot of those techie companies, they probably have cool kitchens. I think every time I go somewhere, like they have like those fully stocked up kitchens. When I went on for a job interview with what the hell bank was it? It was Barclays. They had a really cool kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of those places. I remember being a kid and reading about Google, and that was the draw, was, you know, they had a big cafeteria with a bunch of chefs in it, and they had like a rec room where you could play pool and shit on the job. And yeah, I remember them all saying like, oh, you know, this type of atmosphere fosters, you know, creative thinking. And then the insidious part of that was that really what they wanted to do was they wanted you to spend more hours in the office.
Well, that sounds about right.
Many decades later, we've come to realize that that was the beginning of work encroaching into the home space, you know, the personal life space.
Any day I would take an extra $5,000 a year over being able to go to an office that had a rec room.
Absolutely. And that's the argument most people are saying now. They'd rather get paid more and have better hours than, you know, go to an office. It's like, oh, but, you know, but we have a koi pond. Like, nobody gives a shit.
It's bring your animal to work day.
There was one, I remember there was one thing where the office, the whole office, and I get the people were involved. So it's not like this was a mandated thing or anything. Everybody in the office decided to do it, but there was like a week where they were like all naked. Like, there's not many worse ideas I could think of. They wanted to see how it challenged, like, you know, the perception of wearing clothes. Like, I have fucking no idea. But yeah, I would, the second that a memo like that even got passed around the office, like, hey, just so you know, you don't have to participate in this, but how would everybody feel about this? I would literally, like, that day be like, well, I am going on Indeed, and I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Well, actually, I think I'm going to time out myself at this point. I think maybe we should probably end this on a positive note.
Yeah, I think we are over an hour at this point. So thank you all for listening this week. Next week, we finally have our first guest on to discuss their new business. Looking forward to all you hearing next week.
Going to be exciting. Stick around.